On the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Alice Bryant will present this week's lesson in everyday grammar. Later, Steve Ember will present The Making of a Nation. But first, the new coronavirus has now infected more than 20 million people around the world, a number that has increased by 100% in about 6 weeks. The number of deaths linked to the virus has also increased to more than 745,000. Countries are taking strong measures to limit the spread of COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. And scientists and drug makers are racing to develop a vaccine against the disease. On August 11th, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that his country had become the first to approve a vaccine against COVID-19. The announcement came less than 2 months after the start of human testing of the vaccine with less than 100 people. The Gamaleya Institute in Moscow developed the vaccine. However, it has not yet completed Phase 3 tests involving a large group of volunteers. Alexander Ginsberg, head of the Gamaleya Institute, said that Russia will start its vaccine program while Phase 3 tests continue. Some Western scientists are questioning whether the fast approval, without testing a large group of people, will lead to a safe vaccine. Jonathan Ball is a professor of molecular virology at the University of Nottingham. He said, "Vaccine candidates go through a series of trials to ensure that they are safe and also that they work." He noted that any COVID-19 vaccine will need to protect high-risk groups of people, those who are older or with existing health conditions. The World Health Organization says more than 100 possible vaccines are being developed to protect against COVID-19. But only 6 possible vaccines are currently in Phase 3 trials. Each trial will last for several months and include up to 30,000 people. One vaccine candidate under Phase 3 trial is from Britain's University of Oxford and drug maker AstraZeneca. Sarah Gilbert, a leading scientist in the study, told BBC Radio that it is possible the team will have a vaccine by the end of the year. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the top U.S. infectious diseases expert. He told Reuters recently that a trial by Moderna and the National Institutes of Health could produce results by November or December. Other efforts, like the joint study from U.S.-based drug maker Pfizer and Germany's BioNTech, will come later. Some experts are not sure whether Phase 3 trials can be completed that soon. The trials must study possible side effects of the vaccines on different groups of people, and they must include thousands of people. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine in Texas said that collecting enough data to prove a vaccine is safe for the world could take until the middle of 2021. Several drug makers are building manufacturing capacity to prepare for vaccine production. The U.S. government has provided billions of dollars to the companies under a program called Operation Warp Speed. Fauci said he expects tens of millions of doses of vaccine to be available in early 2021, and that more than a billion will be ready by the end of next year. Several companies, including Moderna, AstraZeneca, and Pfizer, say they each expect to make more than 1 billion doses next year. That could mean several billion will be available by the end of 2021. The first supplies of vaccine will go to people in developed nations. Countries including Canada, Japan, Britain, and the United States have made agreements with drug makers to produce vaccines for their citizens. The British government said that if the University of Oxford vaccine proves effective, the first 30 million doses would be for Britons. Separately, AstraZeneca signed deals to make at least 300 million doses available for the U.S. and another 400 million for European Union members. The first shots will likely go to people who work in industries like healthcare or those who are at greatest health risk from the virus. The wait time for COVID-19 vaccines will likely be longer for people in developing countries, which do not have early supply deals. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is pushing for vaccine research to be shared between countries. He said, "Nobody should be pushed to the back of the vaccine queue because of where they live or what they earn." One of the efforts to ensure developing countries will get COVID-19 vaccines comes from the vaccine alliance Gavi. Seth Berkley, the head of Gavi, said, "One thing that has been made all too clear is that this disease does not respect borders, which is why this global problem requires a global solution."
This is Everyday Grammar. On many of our programs, we talk about the do's of the English language, how and when to use grammatical forms. But on today's program, we will tell you about some don'ts. In this case, when not to use something. The word to. The word to can act as a preposition, part of a phrasal verb, or part of an infinitive verb, depending on how it is used. Let's begin by discussing when to avoid use of to after the verb go. You have probably heard native English speakers say things like, "I'm going to work," or "I'm going to school." But why don't they say, "I'm going to home"? English learners are generally taught to use to when talking about going to a place. Well, that applies most of the time. However, some words present exceptions. The word home is one of them. Let me explain why. Home seems like a clear noun, right? However, we often use it as an adverb. In fact, this is key to knowing which words do not come with the preposition to. Listen to how this speaker uses home in a question.
"Are you going home? I need a ride to 16th Street."
Here, home is an adverb, not a noun. Notice that the verb is go. After this verb and before some place adverbs, we do not use the preposition to. Now let's talk about other adverbs that follow this rule. The words downstairs and upstairs are place adverbs that describe levels inside a home or building. Listen to how this speaker uses one of them with the verb go.
Let's go downstairs. I want to show you my art collection.
Makes sense so far? Great. Other place adverbs that follow this same rule include there and somewhere. A common mistake of English learners is to say something like, I'm going to there. People will still understand your meaning, but it's good to know the right way, which the following two speakers use. Have a listen.
It's my birthday. I want to go somewhere special.
How about the local vineyard? Renee is going there for her birthday next week.
There are a few more place adverbs that are not preceded by the preposition to when used with the verb go. They include inside, outside, underground, abroad, and downtown. It's also worth noting that this applies to a few verbs other than go. For example, with the verb run, I would say, I have to run downtown rather than I have to run to downtown. The verb arrive is another that never gets the preposition to after it. In other words, avoid saying something like, we arrived to the airport at 5, or responding, okay, great, what time will you arrive to Washington, D.C.? Listen to these speakers correct those two examples.
We arrived at the airport at 5.
Okay, great. What time will you arrive in Washington, D.C.?
Note, however, that the phrasal verb get to is much more common than arrive. So you might hear native English speakers say this instead.
We got to the airport at 5.
Okay, great. What time will you get to Washington, D.C.?
Even with the verb get to, we sometimes take out the to, such as when using the place adverbs we have been discussing. In other words, saying, I got downtown at noon is right, while saying, I got to downtown at noon is not. The next verbs are stop and prevent. These verbs mean the same thing, but stop sounds more natural in everyday speaking and writing. Avoid using to after these verbs. The usual sentence structure is to follow them with an object, then the preposition from, and then a gerund. That's a lot easier than it sounds. Here is proof.
The password prevents people from stealing your information.
The password stops people from stealing your information.
The object here is people, followed by the preposition from and the gerund stealing. And finally, we move to causative verbs. You may remember earlier programs that discussed causatives, such as let and make. There are more than 10 causative verbs in English. Most are followed by an infinitive verb. However, a few are only followed by the base form of verbs. Let and make are examples of this. Listen to this speaker use let and pay attention for what verb comes after.
Our friend let us take some veggies from his garden.
She used the base form of the verb take. Notice that she did not say Our friend let us to take some veggies from his garden. So, what can you do with this information? Well, first, remember that using to in the wrong places usually will not stop others from understanding you. Next, avoid trying to memorize what you learned today. Instead, pay attention for the place adverbs and verbs wherever English is being used. Then, ask yourself if the word to is present. I'm Alice Bryant.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we look at the history of early American Indians. Here is Steve Ember.
The native peoples of North and South America came from Siberia thousands of years ago. There was a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska before the end of the last ice age. As the group settled different parts of the land, they developed their own cultures and religions. Each group's story is important in the history of the Americas. But our story today will focus on the tribes in what became the central part of the United States. In 1804, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark led a group of explorers to the Pacific Ocean. They met the tribes of the Great Plains. The explorers were perhaps the first white people these Native Americans had ever seen. When the group of explorers neared the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, they encountered the Shoshone tribe. Meriwether Lewis was the first to see them. Imagine for a moment that we are with Meriwether Lewis near the Rocky Mountains. Across a small hill, a group of 60 Shoshone men are riding toward us. The first thing we see is that these men are ready for war. Each is armed with a bow and arrow. Some carry long poles with a sharp knife at the end. They are riding very fast. Some of the horses look like they do not have riders. But as they get closer, we see that the riders are hanging off the sides of the horses or under the neck. They are using the horses' bodies for protection. The horses are painted with many different designs in blue, black, red, and other colors. Later, we learn that each design has a special meaning for the man who owns the horse. Each one tells a story. For example, the rider of one of the horses is a leader in battle. Another has killed an enemy. As they come nearer, the Shoshone group sees that we are not ready for war. They slow their horses, but are still very careful. Meriwether Lewis holds up an open hand as a sign of peace. The leader of the Shoshone does the same. They come closer. The Shoshone are dressed in clothes made from animal skins. Most of these skins are from deer or buffalo. The skins also have designs and tell stories like the designs on the horses. One design shows that someone has fought in a battle. Another shows that the person has been in many raids to capture horses. Still another shows that someone saved the life of a friend. Meriwether Lewis smiles at these men. He and the Shoshone chief cannot speak each other's language. The explorer again makes a sign of peace, and the sign is again returned. One young Shoshone comes near. He gets off his horse. He is tall and looks strong. His hair is long and black. He wears one long bird feather in the back of his hair. His arms have been painted with long lines. We learn that each line represents a battle. There are many lines on his arms. Fortunately, we are able to continue our travels without a need for him to add another line. Many tribes, including the Shoshone, populated the area known as the Great Plains. The land they lived on influenced the lives and cultures of these Indian nations. The plains stretch across the central part of the country and north into Canada and south to Mexico. Even in a car traveling at 100 kilometers an hour, it can take 2 long days of driving to cross the Great Plains. In the east, the plains begin near the Mississippi River and go west to the huge Rocky Mountains. There are big rivers here and deserts. Some areas are so flat that a person can see for hundreds of kilometers. Huge areas of this land were once covered by thick grasses. Those grasses provided food for an animal that made possible the culture of the Indians of the Great Plains. The grass fed the buffalo or bison that were the center of native culture in the Great Plains. The huge animals provided meat for the Indians and much more. They were an important part of the religion of most of the native people of the Great Plains. The Lakota tribe, sometimes called the Sioux, believed that everything necessary for life could be found in the buffalo. The back of the animal provided the thick skins that the Plains Indians used to make their homes. Other parts of the buffalo hide were made into clothing and warm blankets. The bones were made into tools. No part of the animal was wasted. No one knows how many buffalo were in North America when Meriwether Lewis first met the Shoshone. But experts believe there were probably between 60 million and 75 million. Another animal also played an important part in the Indian cultures of the Great Plains. When Native Americans first saw these animals, they called them big dogs or mystery dogs. They had no word for this kind of animal in their languages. We know it as the horse. The horse had long been extinct in North America.
You have to understand that there were horse species here, you know, millions of years ago, but they died out 10,000 years ago, and so no one had seen a horse.
Until the arrival of Christopher Columbus and other Spanish explorers. Emil Hermeni Horses, curator at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, describes the, at first, frightening sight to the Native Americans.
So what comes back with the Spaniards, with Christopher Columbus on his second voyage, are horses as we know them today, the large animals. And so you can understand that people who had never seen these before, then to see a rider on top of it, dressed in armor, it must have looked like this tank coming at you that you did not know what it was. So, of course, it struck fear. The Spaniards, the conquistadors capitalized on that, realizing that it was causing fear and confusion, that they actually put bells on here. So even adding that extra level of noise to frighten the natives who never encountered the horse.
Before the introduction of horses to North America, Indians mostly traveled by foot. Traveling long distances was difficult. So was hunting buffalo. The horse greatly changed life for the tribes of the Great Plains. It gave them a new way to travel and to carry food and equipment. It made it easier and safer for them to follow and hunt the buffalo.
Originally, you may have killed one or two buffalo, where if you're on horseback, you'd be able to kill more buffalo.
The Smithsonian's Emil Hermeni Horses, who is a member of the Oglala Lakota.
And with killing more buffalo, you had more meat, you had more resources to make clothing from the hides, and also to make teepees. So things became more and bigger. So you might see a bigger teepee because you had more hides, you were able to kill more buffalo and process it, and so more abundance.
The horse made it possible to attack an enemy far away and return safely. The measure of a tribe's wealth became the number of horses it owned. Spanish settlers rode horses to the small town of Santa Fe in what is now the southwestern state of New Mexico. They arrived there in about 1609. How Native Americans got their first horses is not known. Perhaps they traded for them, perhaps they captured them. Soon, many tribes were doing both. By the 1750s, all the tribes of the Great Plains had horses. They had become experts at raising, training, and riding them. And they became experts at horse medicine. Indians of the Great Plains could ride a horse by the age of 5. As an adult, a man would have one horse for work. Another would be specially trained for hunting.
A horse would be trained to ride into the herd. You know, and buffaloes are noted as being, although they're huge and their size, but they can turn very quickly. So a horse had to be ready and be able to anticipate that. So you did have hunting horses that were trained to ride into a herd of buffalo.
And a third would be trained for war. An Indian warrior's success depended on how closely he and his horse worked together.
You wanted to train this horse. I mean, you were one in battle with the horse. When you went into battle, you were a brother, an ally, a comrade. So the horse was trained to fight in close skirmishes.
George Catlin was an artist who traveled in the early American West. He painted many pictures of the Indians and their horses. Catlin said the Plains Indian was the greatest rider the world had ever known. He said the moment an Indian laid a hand on his horse, he became part of the animal. Both the buffalo and the horse were extremely important to the Plains Indians. Because the horse made hunting easier, more time could be spent on other activities, including art. The Plains Indians began to make designs on their clothing and on blankets for their horses. The arrival of white settlers on the Great Plains marked the beginning of the end for the horse and buffalo culture of the Indians. Settlers did not want buffalo destroying their crops. Great numbers of buffalo were killed. By 1885, the Indians of the Great Plains were mostly restricted to areas called reservations.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.